Welcome to another episode of the Armchair Survivalist. Today is November 24th in the year 2019, and I'm the Armchair Survivalist, Kurt Wilson, the owner of Survival Enterprises in beautiful downtown Hayden, Idaho. And like I always say, if you're listening to me, well, obviously you know how to listen to me, but almost every week there's a new way to listen to me. If you go to armchairsurvivalist.com, any of the pages, scroll down, and you will see ways to listen. I'm on a whole bunch of different, podcast, Stitcher, Anchor, TuneIn. I'm being archived on the Wayback Machine, which is the Internet Archive. Podbean, I'm on iHeartRadio. My shows are on YouTube. And when I say shows, I mean radio shows, because I have a face made for radio, not TV. And then there's a whole bunch of other, and I don't know them all, Google, Apple Play. There's so many of these different ones that it's just, there's too many of them. And then if you know what to do with an RSS feed, well, that's there too. You can listen on your satellite system, Global Star 3 satellite system. When you scroll down under the ways to listen, you will see the little satellite dish that's going back and forth. 24/7 live feed is there if you want to listen to Global Star 3 24/7. Not just me, but everyone who's on there. You can listen in a chat room, armchairsurvivalist.com/chat.html. You can listen in there, or you can go into the chat and talk. And I've been on the air for 20 years now. We've had the chat room now for 20 years. But now that people can listen in all kinds of different ways, they're not listening. They're not going to the chat room. So we might just do away with the chat room. We still have, you can listen there, but we'll see. We'll see what happens. You can also listen on your phone. Now, it's not toll free. So if there is a toll for you, you'll have to pay that. But if you got any sense at all, you have one of these phone plans that give you unlimited access. Area code 641-741-0371. That's 641-741-0371. And if you have any questions, comments, if you want to offer me any information, at the bottom of every one of my pages is an email link. You can email me kw@armchairsurvivalist.com. That's kw@armchairsurvivalist.com. Not much news for the company right now, Survival Enterprises. If you're going to be buying liquids, you know, it hasn't really frozen solid everywhere around here yet. It's still getting cold. Winter's still creeping in. There's a polar vortex hitting hard and coming in really bad this coming week. So if you're going to be ordering liquids like colloidal minerals, colloidal silver, Lugol's iodine, whatever it is that we have that's liquid. In fact, whatever it is anybody has that's a liquid, you best order it as quickly as possible before it gets frozen. Because you know what happens when liquid freezes, it expands, breaks a bottle, and then everybody has a hissy fit, you, me, and UPS. So buy those liquid things as quickly as you can. The store has some stuff. We're closing out survival food tabs. I've sold those for over 20 years. Heirloom seeds. These are canned. These are packaged in Mylar bags that are then canned in number 10 cans for long-term storage. These are the kind of seeds you plant, and you can harvest the seeds from them to plant further. And hot pepper seeds. I have some. And these are good gifts. They're like a little tiny soup can that has plant medium in it, and 5 to 10 hot pepper seeds. When I say hot pepper, I'm talking moruga and scorpion. You follow the instructions, keep them warm, give them a little bit of water, not too much, and they'll sprout up. And when you get the sprouts about 3 or 4 inches tall, you separate them out and you put them in separate pots. That's if you want to really do this right. You can leave them in that little tiny can and just brag about it to your friends, or you can grow them. I ended up with 4 4-foot plants. Of course, the deer, believe it or not, ate them. They liked them. Go figure. Anyway, let's get into the economy. Well, there's been notices, and I've been getting alerts from Bank of America, Chase, Capital One. Their ATMs are down. Credit card use is down. My credit card, I couldn't figure it out. I'm trying to run a charge, just $50, and it declined it. And then it didn't decline it. Then it refused it. And then there's all kinds of problems that are happening now. And it's very confusing. There's a lot of, let's just say, conspiracy theories about this. This is the test. These three banks are not connected. But they keep going down. I'm going to have, now on my page, armchairsurvivalist.com, on the left-hand side, you'll see show notes. You find the date of the show that you want to research, and you click on that, and it'll take you to a page that has all the links that I talk about. I will have all the links to Down Detector, which shows you when your bank is down and how often it's down and all of that. So you'll see all the links that I'm going to be talking about. Now, here's a link that I haven't talked about in a number of years because, well, it wasn't that important. It's the FDIC.gov failed bank list. These are banks that have been failing or that have failed. They're not lightweight banks. Let me tell you something. I didn't think to look at them because, well, the last time I looked at this list was 2018, and there were no banks listed at 2018. I'm looking at 2019 now. Let's see. Legends Bank, the Enlo State Bank, Cooper, Texas, Louisa Community Bank in Louisa, Kentucky, Resolute Bank in Maumee, Ohio, City National Bank of New Jersey, Newark, New Jersey. These banks have failed. I haven't gone into the description and why fares, why and what, but they have, they're done. This normally, after 2008, we didn't see anything. Well, now we do. So I'm going to start watching the bank and the financial institutions a lot closer because there is so much warnings out there. So many warnings, so much probability of financial collapse and failure. And you know what? I've been in this business 35 years, and I've been on the air for 20 years. And I've been hearing, you know, like everyone else, you hear about how the end is nigh, it's coming, blah, blah, blah. Usually it's just based on people's feelings. But now we're looking at actual statistics, and it has nothing to do with Trump. It has nothing to do with the Republicans. It has to do with stuff that's happening in conjunction with all of our actions, such as taking out paycheck loans and auto loans and house mortgages and just more nasty things that have been happening. Most of us are attributing to these things, and they're starting to catch up. Now, I've talked about Uber. You know who Uber is, right? Okay, so I've been talking about Uber, and I've talked about Uber before, and I've looked at some of the financials on them, and I could see that they're losing their butt. We're talking losing money. Losing money. Well, I listened to this little clip this week.
Well, the gig could be up for Uber. That stock is hitting record lows. The company CEO saying he really doesn't believe that it will be turning a profit until at least 2021. That facing a $1 billion loss in the latest quarter. Tech analyst John Meyer on what that means for maybe not only Uber, but the ride-sharing industry itself. What's going on?
Well, there's a lot going on with Uber. First and foremost, they're obviously the pinnacle of, aside from WeWork, unprofitable tech startups that also have a very difficult road to profitability in the first place. The second issue, and that is something that is far more pressing right now, and I mean today, is the fact that this week, the amount of shares available for trading with Uber are going from 200 million all the way up to 1.5 billion, and that's because of lockups from Uber employees expiring this week, which I'm extremely concerned about for the stock, because if you're an employee in Uber and you've been partially compensated with RSUs or restricted stock units over the last 5 years or so, you're going to sell some of those shares. And there's a lot of employees that are getting ready to hit that sell button, you know, this week.
Now, it could just be a coincidence, but one of the co-founders of Uber, Travis Kalanick, just unloaded $547 million worth of shares for Uber. Well, we'll see what happens. By the way, Uber's going to start, and they're already doing this right now in South America. They're going to start recording the trips. So when you get into an Uber, you're going to be recorded. There's, you know what's happening all over the world. Uber drivers, phony Uber drivers, are raping and robbing and killing people. Not, you know, 1,000 a day or anything like that, but enough to where Uber's getting a bad name or has a bad name. So they figured, you know what, we're just going to start recording everything. We'll see what happens. New York Times stock plunges after company reports continued declines. The New York Times is another one of these fake news organizations, and always has been since the early 1900s. Here's another one that's just as bad. Oh, this one's even worse. McClatchy. McClatchy is Sacramento Bee, Modesto Bee. Any newspaper with the word Bee in it, B-E-E, is a... Now, the company McClatchy Family, and I knew them when I was a kid. There's a school in Sacramento named after them, McClatchy High. They're socialists. They've always been socialists. They promote all socialism. And I remember one time I placed an ad when I had my gun shop. I placed an ad in Modesto Bee. It was a half-page ad, and it said, President's Week Sale. And I spelled week, W-E-A-K. President's Week Sale, in honor of the president and her husband. Well, it ran on Monday. It was supposed to run Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. It ran on Monday. And Tuesday, I got a phone call from the executive editor at the Modesto Bee, and he said, Mr. Wilson, we're going to have to cancel your ad, and I'm going to give you your money back for it. And I said, well, why? And he said, well, it's politically incorrect. I said, you mean it's grammatically incorrect? He goes, no, it's politically incorrect. We can't have you insulting the president and his wife like this. So we're going to cancel the ad. I said, you do understand that's a violation of my First Amendment rights. And he said, Mr. Wilson, you have no rights when it comes to us. So, yeah, I hope they do go bankrupt. That would be great. Well, we'll see what happens with them. Let's see. Now, there is a accumulation of something called a global debt. It's every loan taken out everywhere on the planet, if you can believe that. And they keep track of this stuff. We're the highest there is, has ever been in history. $188 trillion. How is that ever going to be paid back? Do you get in the mail all of these different coupons, a little pamphlet that says, you get 10% off of this place, 5% off of this, 20% if you buy two or more, blah, blah, blah. Well, Burger King came out with some discount coupons. Unfortunately, what they did was you could put two of these coupons together and use them and buy a meal. They ended up losing $1.50 on every sale because they screwed up. I don't want to read the whole thing on it, but it cost them $12.4 million in revenue. $12.4 million because somebody screwed up. Well, that happens. I can tell you, when was 1973 or 4, Safeway got caught by the Department of Weights and Measures. They were charging 1 cent extra for toilet paper per roll. 1 cent per roll of toilet paper. And it was just a programming error. They had just started using specialized computers and they changed all the programming. And this is nationwide. So the federal government made them pay to the federal government $3.2 million, which is not a fine. It was paying back that 1 cent per roll. So this stuff adds up. All right, now we're going into Food and Health Department. As I mentioned earlier, the polar vortex is coming down. This is going to be, and I saw this last week, that this can be the coldest winter on record. It's going to get really cold. I don't know about levels of snow yet, but I do know, according to all records, it's going to be cold. So if you need equipment, you better get out and do it now. If you have a chance, like up here, we haven't had real snow yet. We've had a snow, an inch or two here and there, but it's gone by noon. Before it hits, you need to get your stuff done. If you need to get your snow blower out of the shed and bring it up towards the front of the house, do it. If you're out of snow shovels, if you've used them up like I do all the time, make sure you get some more and get them where you can get to them without having to walk through 2 to 3 feet of snow. Just think ahead. You need new boots, you need gloves, you need hat, you need whatever you need. Get out and do it before it's too late to do it. Alaska, and I've never heard of this, Alaska broke both records in heat and snowfall in a single day. Anchorage. They had the highest temperature on record in the same day that they had the first snow. That's unique. 25,000 pounds of pizza topping is being recalled. This is going to get worse and worse, and I'm seeing it getting worse and worse every single day, because I get briefings from the Department of Homeland Security and all of their under categories, the FDA, the ATF, the FBI, the USDA, and they are recalling so many things. Sliced pepperoni, chopped pepperoni and sausage. This is the stuff you buy and put on your pizza. This is getting worse. And I told you why. And this is all E. coli. What does E. coli come from? E. coli comes out of the intestinal tract of healthy mammals. And I mean healthy mammals, because once it's out of the tract, it starts gaining strength and becomes a bad bacteria. So what does that mean in English? That means somehow poop is getting put onto your food. And when they track this back, yeah, almost every time, there's an outbreak, another E. coli outbreak, 100,000 pounds of salads, romaine lettuce and other lettuce that come out of California. Now, why? Because the majority of the people that harvest this stuff and process all of these foods are immigrants. Mexican, Muslim, they come from countries that are not, they don't teach hygiene. So this happens so often that it's literally blowing my mind. I'm almost afraid to buy anything from any store. Whatever you buy, first off, if you have any romaine lettuce or iceberg lettuce that comes out of Salinas, California, throw it away. And then wash your hands in hot soapy water. Wash everything that it came in contact with in hot soapy water. All food that you buy, vegetables and fruits, all of them, wash them. Rinse them well. Clean them. And ignore any signs on the packages that say pre-washed. This is getting worse and worse, and it's going to get worse and worse. There's nothing that we can do about it, because the powers that be have decided that these people should be allowed free reign in the United States. In spite of the effects they create on others, it doesn't matter anymore. Like a Kansas restaurant, a waiter comes to the owner of the restaurant and says, oh, by the way, I'm not only a sexual deviant, I have HIV. Well, the restaurant owner fired him. Not on the spot, you know, kind of wiggle around a little bit, and then ended up firing him. The guy's suing the restaurant. So here's this guy with a disease that's communicable and is generally a death sentence. And he wants to serve food. I'll tell you what, all of you out there, and that includes me, and I'm telling you right now, I got some alcohol wipes I'm going to start using. They were doing some testing on smartphones. I don't mean do they work. I mean how much E. coli was on the smartphones. Most people take, and I'm not kidding you, my son goes in the bathroom. You know what he does? He sits in the toilet, takes his phone out and starts poking on it. In the bathroom, right? You ever clean your phone? You ever wash it? 25% of the people that it's a research survey that was done in New York. Tens of millions of people carry the smartphones with them everywhere they go, and that includes the bathroom. I've talked about this before. You know, if you can smell it, what you smell is actually microscopic particles of the item. So if you're smelling poop, you're actually not smelling it. Your nose hairs are licking it. And it's going onto your skin. It's going into your mouth, your nose, your eyes. And if you have your smartphone there, it's going on that. So these phones are dangerous. You know, get some alcohol wipes. Clean your phone down. The information came out this week about a new drug that came out. It's 10,000 times stronger than morphine. And 100 times stronger than fentanyl. And it showed up 4 hours from here in Seattle, Washington. It was detected in March. I don't know. It is extremely deadly. And you know what's going to happen. There's going to be people starting to drop dead from using these kind of drugs. Now we're going to get in the category of Islam. Well, let's see. in London. They're issuing bleed control kits for all the bars there because the Muslims like knives and sharp instruments, and they tend to stab and slice people. In fact, in Europe, Muslims are responsible for 91% of all what they call terrorism deaths. Germany has about 35% of its population are these criminal aliens, these invaders, these Muslims. And a lot of the cities in Germany have a 70% majority of Muslim. Most people go, oh, so what? So they have a majority, you know, so what? Just ignore that city. Well, here's the problem. These people vote. And that's how it's called jihad by immigration. That's how Islam takes over cities in the civilized countries. We just lost complete control of Virginia. When I say we, I mean Republicans and conservatives. Everything there is handed over to the Democrats now. Why? Because in the past decade, mass migration, and these are Indians and Koreans and Muslims that have moved into the area, most of them are Democrats. So they vote. In fact, mosques are urging all of their people to vote because they can take over certain areas. And unfortunately, in America, don't vote that much. And these people, all of them go in mass to vote. There's a woman in England named Anne Marie Waters. She formed a For Britain party, and she's under fire for saying that Islam is a killing machine and that people have a right to be fearful of Muslims. And here's what she said last.
Let me tell you what actually whips up fears of Islam. We take it from the top. 9/11, the London Underground bombings, Madrid, Mumbai, Mali, Bali, Northern Nigeria, Sudan, Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Yemen, Pakistan, death for apostasy, death for blasphemy, death for adultery, death for homosexuality, gender segregation, gender discrimination, unequal testimony between men and women in legal proceedings, child marriage, amputations, beheadings, imprisonment for being raped, anti-Semitism, workers, execution, as I've said, for this, that, and the other, the slaughter of Theo van Gogh on the streets of Amsterdam, death threats on the streets of London, butcher those who insult Islam, Muslim patrols in East London telling people they are entering Sharia control zones, polygamous marriages, marriage not requiring the consent of the bride. This is what causes fear of Islam. It is not me, it is not my colleagues on this side. But the point is that it is not I or my fellow debaters on this side who are causing fear of Islam. It is the actions of Muslims that are causing fear of Islam. That is the real world.
And she's right about that. And what happens is people like you, they know the truth, they've seen it, they've read it, they've heard it, and then you get in an argument with somebody who tries to convince you otherwise. And sometimes you acquiesce to them and say, well, maybe you're right. Even the Pope came out and said that Christians are as bad as Muslims. This guy, I mean, he's got to be the Antichrist. Speaking of the Antichrist, Obama, now, you know, I mentioned last week that the CIA had started ISIS and that we were funding them. Well, I have verification of that.
Was moving too slowly, but the fall of Ramadi has galvanized the Iraqi government. So with the additional steps I ordered last month, we're speeding up training of ISIL forces, including volunteers from Sunni tribes in Anbar province.
ISIL, ISIS, same creatures. All right, so now we're going to get into liberal psychosis. I hear all the time the argument that, well, what are you worried about? There's only 10 million criminal aliens in the United States. There's only 10 million of them. Why are you worried? Well, and I've been saying for years, there's 20 to 40 million. Well, there was a survey done that estimated there's at least 29.5 million criminal aliens in the United States. A lot more than they are trying to believe us. Well, let's see. Now, see, it's really difficult under the liberal psychosis to organize this stuff because their psychosis is exhibited over so many categories, it's astounding. let's see, Reuters scrubbed a story about detained children. They were talking about how thousands of children were detained and put in cages. But when they found out it was done by Obama, not Trump, they scrubbed the story. And then there's all of these actions that are being committed, these crimes that are being committed by criminal aliens nationwide are being ignored. I found a website, North Carolinians for Immigration Reform and Enforcement. These articles aren't even in the newspapers. 30 illegal aliens arrested for 77 child rape and assault charges in North Carolina. This is only in North Carolina. That was October. September, 17 arrested for child rape. August, 21 illegals arrested for 61 child rapes. July, they were really busy. 29 illegal aliens arrested for 174 child rapes. June, 20 illegals arrested for 56 child rapes. May, 29 illegals arrested for 43. April, you see where I'm going here? These are rapes of children that the illegals are doing. And this goes back. 2019, 18, 17, 16, 15. And it goes back and back and back. This is what they do. Once they step over the border illegally, this is like any other criminal. The first crime is the hardest. From there, it's easy. And they do anything they want because they have no respect for this nation in any way, shape, or form. Oh, the Mexican fence separating us from Mexico. Trump is building this fence, right, or repairing a bunch of panels. A month or so ago, I saw them dropping one of these panels, and I'm, what are they, 20 feet high? They're slats. They're steel slats, so you can see through it. And I don't know, maybe they're 4 inches apart. It's a joke. At the time, I said, what are you kidding me? Well, it turns out that Harbor Freight sells a die grinder that the Mexicans go and buy, and they just cut those slats off. In fact, it got so bad, they cut a hole in the fence big enough to drive a truck through. Well, let's see. California. They overhaul the sex education guidance for teachers. What do you think it says? What do you think? I bet you can guess. It's promoting sexual deviance in every form to children as young as 6 years old. Catholic Adoption Agency in Pennsylvania closed because they refused. Now, this company, this business, this Catholic Adoption Agency has been in business for 65 years. They refused to perform gay adoptions. You know what gay adoptions are. It's grooming of a child to become a sexual deviant. Colorado parents upset high school teacher assigned sexually explicit material. You know, I got to tell you something. In all the years I've been doing radio, I have my show notes, right? And I look through all the articles that I want to talk about. Once in a while, I'll kick one out because it's too disgusting to talk about. And that's been maybe once a month. I'm finding articles that I can't talk about because they're so disgusting and pure evil that I don't want to upset you. And I'm finding them every day. Every day. And, you know, I can tell you right away, the culprits are always liberals. Every single time. Illinois school district has decided that the transvestite children, again, you have transvestites, that's males that pretend they're females, and then you have lesbians or butch dyke that are females that want to pretend they're males. So the liberals dreamed up a word for that called transgender. So, Illinois School District decides transgender students have unrestricted access to both bathrooms. So, your 9-year-old daughter can have a 10-year-old boy in the same bathroom as her. Warren, one of these Pocahontas, Trump calls her, running for president. She wants to be the Democrat choice to run against him. She's nuts. She's wacko. And she comes out And she said, now I'll quote you what she said. Black, trans, and cis women, gender nonconforming, and non-binary people are the backbone of our democracy. I haven't a damn clue what the hell she's saying. Except maybe she's saying deviance, to sum it up. Sexual deviance are the backbone of our democracy. Well, considering we don't have a democracy here, we have a republic, she should be perfect to run as a Democrat. And there's, every once in a while, we get these articles in the newspaper or on a radio about some transgender child. Some 7-year-old, 8-year-old, 9-year-old, who their sick, perverted Democrat parent wants the kid to not be whatever gender it really is. Well, there's a drug you use. It's a puberty blocking drug that's used on trans kids, kids that are trying to want to be a boy instead of a girl, or want to be a girl instead of a boy. Well, this drug, it's standard operating procedure to give them this drug. There has been 25,000 reactions logged. Because with the Centers for Disease Control, they log reactions to a drug. If you take penicillin and you break out in a rash, the doctor contacts the CDC and files a reaction. Not just reactions, there's been 6,400 deaths. These are children that have died because their perverted parents have convinced them that they needed to be the opposite gender. Chick-fil-A. Remember Chick-fil-A, right? That nice restaurant, the restaurant that all Democrats, liberals, socialists, communists, and sexual perverts hate. Well, I guess Chick-fil-A decided that because 1% of the population was giving them a ration of crap, they're going to conform to the lowest common denominator in the United States. And they have decided to no longer donate funds to, evil places like the Salvation Army, Fellowship of Christian Athletes, the Paul Anderson Youth Home in Georgia. In fact, they've backed away from every Christian organization. Chick-fil-A has backed away from every Christian organization in the United States because Chick-fil-A wants to expand themselves and be more inclusive. Well, let's see. A lesbian married a woman and then decided she wanted to be a priest and went to a school, a college, to learn all the, you know, the theology and things like that, and they found out that she was a pervert and kicked her out. And of course she's suing them for that. Now this article is from the communist organization that the Democrats get their talking points from. It's called the Daily Kos. It's owned by a communist. It's every person that works for him is communist. I don't mean socialist, I mean communist. And they are fake news like you wouldn't believe. They pervert things to such a degree. See, they're pandering to their readers, and their readers are all morons. They're what's called useful idiots. And the title of this article is Flat Earth Conspiracy is Growing, Especially Among Born-Again Religious Zealots. Now, Islam is a religion of peace, whereas Christianity, if you're in it, you're a zealot. And they're saying that 1 out of 6 American adults, 1 out of 6, believe that the earth is flat. I have no idea where they get these things, but the bad thing is that the readers believe them. Christianity is under attack, and it has been for decades, and all over the world. Now, it's come to the United States, and it's getting worse and worse, and that's been going on for the past, 40 years. In Durham, New Hampshire, they announced they're removing the Christmas trees because two people complained about being offended. Talk about politically correct. A tenured professor quit Columbia University because he felt like he was living under communism. This is a guy who came from Romania. He lived under communism. He knew what it was like. And when they wanted to, he said the breaking point was this: when they decided to have a transvestite play Juliet in the Romeo and Juliet. Now, here's the thing. He's the head of the drama department. So they wanted to have a sexual deviant, a transvestite, be Juliet in Romeo and Juliet. He said, no, we're done. We're done with this. Oh, you remember there was a website that had been created, and I forgot. It's of no importance, so I didn't remember it. But it was put up by a bunch of I hate everyone but communists, and well, they got embarrassed and kicked off the server, so they come out with a new shtick. This is new, okay? They call themselves the American Independent. AmericanIndependent.com. It's a newspaper, an article site, an internet news site, and the thing is that every single person that works in it is a communist. Every single one. So you can imagine what they're talking about. Talking about how GOP or Americans or Republicans or patriots were all destructful and evil. You've got to go there and read it. It's funny as hell. The American Independent. I'll have the link up. Now, this article proved to me that you can exist without a brain. And this very well could explain Democrats. Woman seeking treatment for dizziness finds out she's missing her cerebellum. This is a part of the brain that's necessary for mobility, for moving. And she's been able to perform fine. She's a little, sluggish and floppy around a little bit now and then, but she's been able to do okay. Did you see the latest Democrat debate they had this week? It's, someone asked me yesterday, how what'd you think of it? I said, all I saw were about a dozen communists trying to out-communist each other. And the funniest part is, and I just found this clip that I got to play for you.
My ideas are not far left. They are the ideas that the American people want.
Okay, the only American people that I have found that want the ideas from this avowed socialist are more socialists. Now we're going into the Trump category. Now, just so you guys know, I've watched every televised proceeding of these so-called impeachment inquiries. Now, according to CNN, ABC, NBC, MSNBC, and the other communist networks, these are the impeachment hearings. New York Times says this. They all say impeachment hearings, not inquiry. Inquiry is where they determine if there's enough data there. You know, I do a lot of research during the week. Things stick in my head, and I pull them up, and I use them or I don't use them. But doing this, after seeing the last joke that the Democrats were putting out, I come across this link, and I thought, you know what? This sums it up.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to have an argument, please.
Sir, have you been here before?
No, this is my first time.
I see. Try Mr. Barnard, room 12.
Thank you.
Hi.
Is this the right room for an argument?
I've told you once.
No, you haven't.
Yes, I have.
When?
Just now.
No, you didn't.
Yes, I did.
Didn't.
I didn't. I'm telling you, I did.
You did not.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is this a 5-minute argument or the full half hour?
Oh, just the 5-minute one.
Fine. Thank you. Anyway, I did.
You most certainly did not.
Now, let's get one thing quite clear. I most definitely told you.
You did not.
Yes, I did.
You did not.
Yes, I did.
Didn't.
Yes, I did.
Didn't.
Yes, I did.
No, this isn't an argument.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't. It's just contradiction.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
It is not.
It is. You just contradicted me.
No, I didn't.
Oh, you did.
No.
You did, just
no,
then.
No, nonsense.
Oh, look, this is futile.
No, it isn't.
I came here for a good argument.
No, you didn't. You came here for an argument.
Well, an argument's not the same as contradiction.
Can be.
No, it can't. An argument's a connected series of statements to establish a definite proposition.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is. It isn't just contradiction.
Look, if I argue with you, I must take up a contrary position.
But it isn't just saying no, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't. Argument's an intellectual process. Contradiction is just the automatic gainsaying of anything the other person says.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
Not at all.
No, look.
Thank you.
Well, Trump had something to say about the whole hearing thing, and he tweeted it out the other day.
Again, I don't recall President Trump ever talking to me about any security assistance, ever.
Did the president ever tell you personally about any preconditions for anything?
No.
Okay, so the president never told you about any preconditions for the aid to be released?
No.
Is it correct? No one on this planet told you that Donald Trump was tying this aid to the investigations? Because if your answer is yes, then the chairman's wrong and the headline on CNN is wrong. No one on this planet told you that President Trump was tying aid to investigations. Yes or no?
Yes.
You called President Trump to ask him, what do you want from Ukraine? He responded, I want nothing. I want no quid pro quo. I want Zelensky to do the right thing. I want him to do what he ran on. And what he ran on was fighting corruption, correct?
Correct.
President said, quote, no quid pro quo. I want nothing. I want nothing. I want President Zelensky to do the right thing. Do what he ran on, end quote. Is that correct?
That's correct.
That means it's all over.
You know what astounded me? And I mean, I was shocked. I watched the last hearing from start to stop. And immediately after the hearing, all the media, including Fox, came out and said, Trump's done. He's hung. Everything is proven. There's too much proof there. And I'm like, what the hell are these people talking about? I'm sure that they heard something that other than I did, because everything I heard was him being cleared. David Nunes says the same thing, and he has a whole different take on this thing.
Throughout these bizarre hearings, the Democrats have struggled to make the case that President Trump committed some impeachable offense on his phone call with Ukrainian President Zelensky. The offense itself changes depending on the day, ranging from quid pro quo to extortion to bribery to obstruction of justice, then back to quid pro quo. It's clear why the Democrats have been forced onto this carousel of accusations. President Trump had good reason to be wary of Ukrainian election meddling against his campaign and of widespread corruption in that country. President Zelensky, who didn't even know aid to Ukraine had been paused at the time of the call, has repeatedly said there was nothing wrong with the conversation. The aid was resumed without the Ukrainians taking the actions they were supposedly being coerced into doing. Aid to Ukraine under President Trump has been much more robust than it was under President Obama, thanks to the provision of Javelin anti-tank weapons. As numerous witnesses have testified, temporary holds on foreign aid occur fairly frequently for many different reasons. So how do we have an impeachable offense here when there's no actual misdeed and no one even claiming to be a victim? The Democrats have tried to solve this dilemma with a simple slogan. He got caught. President Trump, we are to believe, was just about to do something wrong, and getting caught was the only reason he backed down from whatever nefarious thought crime the Democrats are accusing him of almost committing. I once again urge Americans to continue to consider the credibility of the Democrats on this committee who are now hurling these charges. For the last 3 years, it's not President Trump who got caught. It's the Democrats who got caught. They got caught falsely claiming they had more than circumstantial evidence that Trump colluded with Russians to hack the 2016 election. They got caught orchestrating this entire farce with the whistleblower and lying about their secret meetings with him. They got caught defending the false allegations of the Steele dossier, which was paid for by them. They got caught breaking their promise that impeachment would only go forward with bipartisan support because of how damaging it is to the American people. They got caught running a sham impeachment process featuring secret depositions, hidden transcripts, and an unending flood of Democrat leaks to the media. They got caught trying to obtain nude photos of President Trump from Russian pranksters pretending to be Ukrainians. And they got caught covering up for Alexander Chalupa, a Democratic National Committee operative who colluded with Ukrainian officials to smear the Trump campaign by improperly redacting her name from deposition transcripts and refusing to let Americans hear her testimony as a witness in these proceedings. That is the Democrats' pitiful legacy in recent years. They got caught. Meanwhile, their supposed star witness testified that he was guessing that President Trump was tying Ukrainian aid to investigations despite no one telling him that was true. And the president himself explicitly telling him the opposite, that he wanted nothing from Ukraine. Ladies and gentlemen, unless the Democrats once again scramble their kangaroo court rules, today's hearing marks the merciful end of this spectacle in the impeachment committee, formerly known as the Intelligence Committee. Whether the Democrats reap the political benefit they want from this impeachment remains to be seen, but the damage they have done to this country will be long-lasting. With this wrenching attempt to overthrow the president, they have pitted Americans against one another and poisoned the mind of fanatics who actually believe the entire galaxy of bizarre accusations they have leveled against the president since the day the American people elected him. I sincerely hope the Democrats end this affair as quickly as possible so our nation can begin to heal the many wounds it has inflicted on us. People's faith in government and their belief that their vote counts for something has been shaken. From the Russia hoax to this shoddy Ukrainian sequel, the Democrats got caught. Let's hope they finally learn a lesson, give their conspiracy theories a rest, and focus on governing for a change.
Personally, I hope they don't focus on governing because we have enough crap going on and harming the citizens of the United States without the Democrats sticking their finger in the tub. By the way, you can go on to Trump's website right now, the Trump Make America Great website. It's a DonaldTrump.com. It's the store. It's shop.DonaldTrump.com. And you can buy the Bullshit t-shirt. Yes, bull spelled out with a picture of Schiff, pencil neck bug eye, bull Schiff. That's cute. I like that. He's Michael Moore, otherwise known as the Blob, came out and he said that the total job one for the Democrats is removing Trump from our White House. This guy, my God, he gets uglier day by day. He's come out and he said that the job number one for the Democrats is removing Trump from the White House. And, of course, he said that the day Trump got elected and inaugurated, and so did Pelosi and so did everyone, all the other Democrats. In fact, Pelosi came out and she told the media that it's dangerous to let the election decide who will be president. That's a weak position. The establishment must decide this, and this is why they're doing this. Now, one of the things that, in fact, the big thing is in this whole hearing thing is that Trump mentioned something about Joe Biden. Well, he actually didn't mention something about Joe Biden, but everybody else is, about how his son's a criminal and how Biden himself is a criminal. I mean, just all of this stuff. And Joe Biden's son and his partners in the company in the Ukraine, Burisma. Well, the Ukrainian government came out this week and released some investigative numbers that Biden's son received $16.5 million from Burisma. Not the $80,000 a month. This is $16.5 million. And on top of that, the company that Hunter Biden worked with received $130 during the when Obama was paying off all these different groups to keep them alive, so to speak. Now, just to let you guys know, if you actually care, there's a website. It's called MAGAPIL, MAGAPIL.com. If you want to know what Trump has accomplished in the short time that he's been in, there are lists here. Government, economy, national security. Good Lord. There's no way I could read all of these in 2 hours. These are the things that he has accomplished in the time that he's been in. There has not been a president in the past 20 years that could claim even half of these, even a third of these. And that'll be on my show notes page. You go to armchairsurvivalist.com, and on the left-hand side, you'll see the show notes. And you click on that, and you'll find this. You'll find it. There'll be a MAGAPIL link. I'm astounded by it. It's when you start reading it, and the thing is that you'll read all of these things, and then if you're an astute researcher, you go, well, let me fact check this. It's going to be hard as hell to fact check it because the media is not going to have any of it out there. 99.9% of everything that Trump has accomplished, the media doesn't show it anywhere. Now we're going into the category government threat. Now, government threat is, you have to take the hypothesis that there is a deep state. And that's the government. We're not talking Trump. We're talking underlings behind him, below him, above him, and agencies. And we're talking also Facebook and Google and groups like that. Well, something popped up in October. There was a guy he does research on the dark web. His name is Vinny Troia. And he found, to call it a trove is an understatement. He found about 1.2 billion records, personal records of individuals on a server. It was easy to find and easy to get into. It wasn't secured. It was just on the dark web. That just freaked him out. Now, it doesn't have credit card numbers, bank account numbers, stuff like that. It has names, addresses, phone numbers, email addresses, that kind of stuff. And he couldn't figure out whose it was. It's unknown. The origin's unknown. There were 4 data sets that were cobbled together. 3 were labeled, and 1 was just sitting there. And it was 3 of them were from a data broker in San Francisco called People Data Labs. And it apparently sold this data to somebody. Where it got it, he doesn't know. So there's information, private information, that's sitting on the internet, that's sitting in the dark web, fully accessible to hackers. Now, where he went to look at this was Google Cloud. This is cloud. This is the cloud, right? This is data from people who are stupid enough to store their private information on somebody else's hard drive. That's what a cloud is. When somebody says free storage on the cloud, that means on their hard drive. So people store their stuff on there, say, well, you know, that's great. I don't need to have a hard drive in my computer. I can have a laptop that's a quarter inch thick because I don't need a hard drive. I can use the cloud. Now, remember what a cloud is. It's somebody else's hard drive. So when you store your stuff on a cloud, you're giving it to somebody else. If you don't have it stored in-house, well, then you're just pretty much screwed. Every week I come up and I tell you a different... And it's not hacked. It's not a hack job at all. It's not somebody got the password and logged in. No, they just simply found it. It's stored on a cloud somewhere. And your information is like redundant. I found myself in a file of 5 billion other people. And all it had was my name and address. And it was the wrong address, but still it had it. Which kind of upset me, but what are you going to do? So... Now, here's the other thing. The Department of Justice is allowing other police agencies to see your private data. Foreign police agencies. This is happening. This has been happening now for, I don't know, 30, 40 years. And it just, now people are just now noticing it. I don't understand why they're just not noticing it. But Interpol can always get the data from our Department of Justice files. And now it's coming out into the open. And it's like, well, so this is new? No, it's not. Oh, let's see. What I'm doing here now is this stuff is all jumbled up. I don't have, there's so much that I don't have the time or the ability to organize it into neat categories. I'm just hitting it as it shows up. Foreign-born researchers at U.S. agencies are secretly working for China. I'm always astounded when law enforcement comes out and says, "Oh, look at these guys. We're not even born in America, and they're working at MIT and have all this secret information, and they're actually giving it away to people in their country where they were born, like China." Lawrence Livermore Laboratory. This is about 20 years ago. My uncle was one of the guys that founded Lawrence Livermore Laboratories. They had two Chinese guys working there that were not Americans. They were from China, and they were working there, and they were working on explosive technology. One woman that worked with them went home with one of them to cook him dinner, and she found on one of his tables in his front room piles and piles of data that are top secret that weren't supposed to be there. So she turned him in, and they found both of them had been stealing and copying everything that they've been working on for 10 years. And they were mailing it back to China. So this is another one of these reports. Foreign-born researchers working for U.S. agencies were secretly on China's payroll. And they send sensitive research to China. 10,000 Chinese nationals in 2018 conducted research in the Department of Energy's national labs. 10,000. So China is our enemy, right? Why in hell would they hire 10,000 of them to work in the Department of Energy? This is confusing to me, but it's part of the deep state. They do this stuff because we don't pay attention to it. That's part of it. You know, they want us, and I hate to use the term they because it's a generality, but those who would control us, they want our attention on so many superfluous, stupid things, such as impeachment inquiries, or can I get 25 cents more an hour, or what's new on TV this week? Who's playing who on Monday night? Is there a sale on Budweiser Talls? We're not paying attention to the reality of what's going on, and we're just, you know, it's almost as if there's a group of aardvarks living around the anthill, and they keep putting nectar around the bottom of the anthill so that we can keep feeding ourselves and grow fat, and then at their leisure they come over and eat us up, and we don't know anything. We don't know there's aardvarks out there because we don't know what aardvarks are, but all of a sudden we get licked up and digested. It's always a surprise. You probably know about Project Nightingale from Google. They've been collecting our personal health data. I got to tell you, 5 years ago, I saw this coming when the NSA built their secret establishment in northern Utah. Five layers down of basically storage capability of servers and hard drives and that kind of thing. And then I hear that they're going to be putting out a new rule to where all doctors and dentists and chiropractors, I mean anyone who takes Medicare, you want to get suck off the government's tit, then they want a quid pro quo. In other words, you want something from them, they want something from you. They want you to put on the internet all of the health information of your clients. My chiropractor is going crazy about this right now. He has so much work to do. I come in, I see him, I leave. Then he's got 10 minutes of paperwork to fill out on the internet to transfer to the insurance company. All of that gets posted in one spot. And no secret servers in northern Utah. But the good thing is, quote unquote, good thing, is that now if you go to another chiropractor 1,000 miles away, he can see your file. Same thing with a dentist. Same thing with doctors. I've been hearing complaints from doctors and dentists and all medical professionals that their paperwork load is so extensive now that they're seriously thinking of giving up taking insurance. But, you know, that's how the medical community makes their billions and trillions of dollars. They screw the insurance companies, so they're not going to give it up. But I saw this coming. And I've been seeing it every single day, every single week. We have in the store here at Survival Enterprises, we have the experts, you know, maybe they're not experts, but doctors and dentists and veterinarians. They come in and they buy certain products from us. And I ask them about this stuff. And they say, this is asinine. This is ridiculous. You know, they're asking us to fill out all this information. And it goes to a main clearinghouse, like whoever their programmer is. It goes to him, and then it goes to the government, and the government doles out the pay. But the files are kept in different places. And if you've been following any of the news from Amazon and from Google and from Facebook and some other places that they were talking about, cloud servers and how our government is going to be putting all of the data on these so-called cloud servers. Again, what's a cloud server? It's somebody else's hard drive. Well, this is happening. It happened. Most of you don't even know this, but when this, I would say 40 years ago, there were credit reporting agencies in the United States. And if you owed a tire company $50 and he couldn't get the money from you, well, he would turn it over to this credit reporting agency. And this credit reporting agency would then contact you and say, hey, you need to come in here and pay the $50 or we're going to screw up your credit rating. They had access to credit rating, TransUnion, Equifax, and there were a couple more. But you could get a printout once a year of your credit rating and everything that's transpired during that year. Well, what was happening was those were big government computers, and they'd get cross-wired. I spent 10 years, according to the records, married to my mother. And my sister spent 5 years with 12 children, according to the records. And this is a giant computer. Well, they're long gone, but that kind of stuff still keeps popping up, and it will. Because who programs the computers? Humans do. And sometimes a human is busy looking at his desktop computer screen, which is now four screens, and he's looking at one of them that has Game of Thrones on instead of paying attention to what he's actually doing. So we're having problems. And this Google Project Nightingale is one of them that's been gathering our health data for the government. Except the government didn't authorize it. There is a bill. It's called a landmark bill. It's a big one. It's going to theoretically stop any possibility of enforcing federal red flag gun laws. What's a red flag gun law? Red flag law is a law that allows employers, spouse, children, teachers, or Joe Blow to turn somebody in and say, this guy, I think he's got a gun and I think he's dangerous. So all of a sudden, you get a knock on your door and they come in and they take all your guns. This isn't make-believe. This is real. Now, I don't know if I told you this. These so-called red flag gun laws have been around longer than you think. In 1997, I'm in Modesto, California, and I got a phone call from a pastor friend of mine, and he said, Kurt, the police came to my door at 5 in the morning, and knocked on it, and they came in and they demanded that I give them all of my firearms. And I said, what? What did you do wrong? He said, nothing. I didn't do anything. Somebody in my parish turned me in to them as a possible terrorist because I was against the government and talking about guns. And I mean, he's not a wacko. The guy is, he's what you would call a moderate conservative. So luckily, they allowed me to take possession of all his firearms for 30 days. And then I could give them back to him. But this kind of thing has been going on for a long time. Now, you know, it's a double-edged sword. Sometimes it's a great idea, especially if you got some 13-year-old kid on Facebook who's saying, I think I'm going to kill about 10 people today. I'm going to take my dad's gun and take it to school and shoot some people. Well, yeah, the police proactively go there and take the guns. Okay, but the other side is, now the police know that you have the guns, and the police are doing something that is a violation of the Constitution. It's a violation of so many amendments, it's ridiculous. But we allow it to happen. So a guy in Oklahoma filed a bill, Senator Nathan Dahm, D-A-H-M, obviously Republican, Senate Bill 1081, and this is going in the 2020 legislative session. Under this proposed law, the Oklahoma legislature would occupy and preempt the entire field of legislation in the state touching in any way federal or state extreme risk protection orders or red flag laws. At least that's one guy doing it in a state. Well, let's see if that does anything. We have a problem in the Congress is that we've got, and I could be wrong, I think it's about 30 Republicans are retiring at the end of this year or the end of the term. New York Rep. Peter King is retiring. This is not good. I don't envision the Republicans taking back the House in any way, shape, or form because we're losing people that have been there for many years and have a lot of backup, and they're just sort of going away. Now, here's something that popped up. Now, maybe some of you remember that I was doing some cryptocurrency mining. I have the mining equipment, and I was mining for crypto coins. And there is the whole concept of crypto coins is blockchain. Blockchain is a series of numbers and letters that is very long, very complicated, and once it's created, it can't be modified. Well, I told you I get briefings from Homeland Security, Department of Homeland Security, and I've got a briefing here under Science and Technology where the DHS awards $197,000 for blockchain approach to tracking raw material imports. See, what happens when something comes into country, let's say ascorbic acid, which is vitamin C. Ascorbic acid comes into country. Well, under the bill of lading, you know where it's coming from. It's coming from China. But then that goes to Canada. And some Canadians use it to manufacture a multivitamin. And then that multivitamin is sold in the United States. So all you see is made in Canada. You don't see where their ingredients come from. So what they're doing, this guy's, he's going to be able to track raw materials by creating a blockchain for each raw material. And as that material is used, oh, let's say that ascorbic acid is used to create to mix with Alka-Seltzer. So you get an Alka-Seltzer with sodium bicarbonate, which will have its own blockchain, and ascorbic acid, which will have its own blockchain, and you put that together, and anyone down the road can look at all the blockchains and determine exactly where that raw material came from. Sounds like a great idea, doesn't it? Remember the double-edged sword thing? So that's what we're looking at here. Double-edged sword. Yahoo, Google, Facebook, Twitter, every single one of the social media want to create a blockchain, and so does the government, for that matter, want to create a blockchain for individuals. Never mind a Social Security number. A blockchain. And then you have this blockchain. And then anytime you post anything, anytime you buy anything, sell anything, say anything, they'll know exactly where it comes from, because you can't modify a blockchain. Once it's done, it's made, it's made. This is a thing that's going to be happening, and it probably won't happen for the next maybe 5 years. I don't know. But they're really looking at it, and it's going to remove what's left of any semblance of privacy, especially on the internet. Well, here's the thing that happened in South Africa. You're going to like this. And if my buddy, the mortician's listening, he's going to like this too. South Africa, a family member died, okay? And they contacted the insurance company and said, we like to get the insurance because my relative died. This guy died. And the firm refused to pay because she couldn't prove that he died, even though she had the hospital records and all that stuff. So they simply took his corpse to the insurance company. That handled it right there. Don't know how well that'd work in the United States, but it sure handled it in South Africa. San Francisco's poop problem is getting worse. All right, now it's time for another installment of the Way to Happiness booklet, A Common Sense Guide to Better Living. There's 21 precepts in it. Last week we did number 7, except I messed up and I didn't do all of it. So I'm going to do 7 and 8 today. I'm going to do 7 over again. Number 7, seek to live with the truth. False data can cause one to make stupid mistakes. It can even block one from absorbing true data. One can solve the problems of existence only when he has true data. And the word data means facts. If those around one lie to him or her, one is led into making errors and his survival potential is reduced. False data can come from many sources, academic, social, professional. Many want you to believe things just to suit their own ends. What is true is what is true for you. No one has any right to force data off on you and command you to believe it or else. If it is not true for you, it isn't true. Think your own way through things. Accept what is true for you. Discard the rest. There is nothing unhappier than one who tends to live in a chaos of lives. This is still under seek to live with the truth. The next section of that is do not tell harmful lies. Harmful lies are the product of fear, malice, and envy. They can drive people to acts of desperation. They can ruin lives. They create a kind of trap into which the teller and the target can both fall. Interpersonal and social chaos can result. Many wars begin because of harmful lies. One should learn to detect them and reject them. And the next section is do not bear false witness. There are considerable penalties connected with swearing or testifying to untrue facts. It's called perjury. It has heavy penalties. The way to happiness lies along the road to truth. This is number 7. And I'm looking at this going, you know what? You want to see violations of that? Go look at the impeachment inquiries. Number 8. Do not murder. Most races from the most ancient times to the present have prohibited murder and punished it heavily. Sometimes this has been broadened to say, thou shalt not kill, when a later translation of the same work is found to read, thou shalt not murder. There is a considerable difference between these two words, kill and murder. A prohibition against all killing would rule out self-defense. It would tend to make it illegal to handle a serpent coiling to strike the baby. It would put a race on a diet of vegetables. I'm sure you can see many illustrations of the difficulties raised by a prohibition against all killing. Murder is another thing entirely. By definition, it means the unlawful killing of one or more human being by another, especially with malice aforethought. One can easily see that in this age of violent weaponry, murder would be all too easy. One could not exist in a society where oneself or one's family or friends were at the mercy of some who went about casually taking lives. Murder justly bears the highest priority in social prevention and retaliation. The stupid, the evil, and the insane seek to solve their real or imagined problems with murder, and they've been known to do it for no reason at all. Get behind any demonstrably effective program that handles this threat to mankind and push. Your own survival could depend upon it. The way to happiness does not include murdering or your friends, your family, or yourself being murdered. This final section here is about personal initiative. The problem that we have in the United States, and I don't care about the rest of the world because they're in a worse scenario than we are. The problem we have in the United States is that we personally, individually, are failing at many aspects of life. And my job is to help you figure out certain ways that you can handle things better. This is what a survivalist does, is that you survive better. I like each week to have something that can help you to survive a little bit better. And this week is going to be talking about personal initiative. America has been under attack for over half a century by those that both invalidate and attempt to eradicate American sense of ethics, morals, integrity, responsibility, patriotism, compassion, benevolence, dignity, all the things that have made up the character of Americans since our great country was founded hundreds of years ago. They've gained control of all schools, all media, most churches, whole political parties, and a large number of willing minions in the general population. They persuaded the lazy and weak-minded to follow their degradation of our society to the point we now have lost over four generations of Americans to the concepts of victimhood, entitlement, and self-importance. I can't help the masses to change, but I can help you. The longest trip starts with but a single step. You guys are that step for me. And if you're willing, you can take a step with another, and another, and another. And those that are both willing and deserving will survive. What we're going to be talking about here is personal initiative. It sounds like just some word that somebody blows off somewhere or some archaic politician once used 100 years ago, or maybe your grandma mentioned something about it, or maybe you accidentally read something on a wall that has faded and nobody ever looks at it anymore. But personal initiative is something, and this might sound strange, but personal initiative is so rare that scientists are actually studying it because so few people are actually performing in the realm of personal initiative. And they're trying to figure out why. Why is it so rare now?
If you guys have anyone on your social media like I do that's over the age of 40, you've probably seen them post at some point about how much our generation sucks. Well, as a millennial, I took it upon myself to try to evaluate what's so wrong with our generation and why they're so mad at us. And then I pretty much realized that we're just existing. We're not really contributing anything to society. Our generation doesn't have the basic manners that include no ma'am and yes ma'am. We don't even hold the door open for ladies, much less our elders anymore. We listen to really obscene music that degrades women and pretty much glorifies drugs and crime. We start to cuss now to prove a point. We use words like bae to describe someone we love. And we idolize people like Kim Kardashian, and then we shame people like Tim Tebow. We're lazy, we're really entitled, and we want to make a lot of money and have free education, but we're not really willing to put in the work. We spend more time online making friends and less time actually building relationships. And our relationship's appearance on Facebook is more valuable than the foundation that it's actually built on. Our idea of standing up for something we believe in means going on Facebook and posting a status with your opinion. And we believe the number of followers we have reflects who we are as a person. We don't respect our elders. We don't even respect our country. We're stepping on our flag instead of stepping up to volunteer. And we mock the men and women that are fighting for us, but we praise the people that are fighting each other, guys. We're more divided as a country than ever before. And I think our generation actually has a lot to do with that. Everything that used to be frowned upon is now celebrated. Nothing has value in our generation because we take advantage of everything. We have more opportunities to succeed than any of those before us, yet we don't appreciate the opportunities we have now. Now I guess I see why people call us Generation Y. Like, why are we so entitled? Because we don't deserve to be, and we were raised better than this. I always wonder what we're going to be remembered by, and I, for one, want to break that stereotype and prove that my parents raised me better. Don't you? To all of our elders, I'm sorry. And I do know that we were raised better. Thank you from this millennial for putting up with those and those who do not see wrong in their actions. I hope we start pulling our pants up and actually contributing to the society we love.
Somebody who actually has pulled their head out of wherever they had it stuffed and paid attention around and realized what was going on for her generation anyway. And unfortunately, too many other generations are emulating the millennials because they're the loudest. They're the ones that have the least to do in life. So they can be loud. They can go places. They can riot. They can They can strike. They can mobilize their forces, quote unquote, while the rest of us have to work. The problem with an entitlement class, which is what millennials are, is that they are self-important. In other words, they determine that they are more important than those around them. They are more important than somebody or something else. And in the same vein, they think that they know it all. Of course, you know, Socrates said the same thing about children. They act like they know it all. Well, unfortunately, I, as a business owner, have seen examples of this where I was a master gunsmith for 25 years, and I would have somebody, and this is real, guy comes in, he wants a job as my apprentice, and I was actually looking for an apprentice. So I said, well, what do you know about firearms? He goes, oh, nothing, but I can pick it up. I learn fast. I go, well, you have to have some kind of background in it. He goes, I watched movies. I've seen TV. I know all about guns. This guy knew, he thought he knew more than he actually does. Now, there's a problem with that, and I want you to hear it.
Are you as good at things as you think you are? How good are you at managing money? What about reading people's emotions? How healthy are you compared to other people you know? Are you better than average at grammar? Knowing how competent we are and how our skills stack up against other people's is more than a self-esteem boost. It helps us figure out when we can forge ahead on our own decisions and instincts and when we need instead to seek out advice. But psychological research suggests that we're not very good at evaluating ourselves accurately. In fact, we frequently overestimate our own abilities. Researchers have a name for this phenomenon, the Dunning-Kruger effect. This effect explains why more than 100 studies have shown that people display illusory superiority. We judge ourselves as better than others to a degree that violates the laws of math. When software engineers at two companies were asked to rate their performance, 32% of the engineers at one company and 42% at the other put themselves in the top 5%. In another study, 88% of American drivers described themselves as having above average driving skills. These aren't isolated findings. On average, people tend to rate themselves better than most in disciplines ranging from health, leadership skills, ethics, and beyond. What's particularly interesting is that those with the least ability are often the most likely to overrate their skills to the greatest extent. People measurably poor at logical reasoning, grammar, financial knowledge, math, emotional intelligence, running medical lab tests, and chess all tend to rate their expertise almost as favorably as actual experts do. So who's most vulnerable to this delusion? Sadly, all of us, because we all have pockets of incompetence we don't recognize. But why? When psychologists Dunning and Kruger first described the effect in 1999, they argued that people lacking knowledge and skill in particular areas suffer a double curse. First, they make mistakes and reach poor decisions. But second, those same knowledge gaps also prevent them from catching their errors. In other words, poor performers lack the very expertise needed to recognize how badly they're doing. For example, when the researchers studied participants in a college debate tournament, the bottom 25% of teams in preliminary rounds lost nearly 4 out of every 5 matches. But they thought they were winning almost 60%. Without a strong grasp of the rules of debate, the students simply couldn't recognize when or how often their arguments broke down. The Dunning-Kruger effect isn't a question of ego blinding us to our weaknesses. People usually do admit their deficits once they can spot them. In one study, students who had initially done badly on a logic quiz and then took a mini course on logic were quite willing to label their original performances as awful. That may be why people with a moderate amount of experience or expertise often have less confidence in their abilities. They know enough to know that there's a lot they don't know. Meanwhile, experts tend to be aware of just how knowledgeable they are, but they often make a different mistake. They assume that everyone else is knowledgeable too. The result is that people, whether they're inept or highly skilled, are often caught in a bubble of inaccurate self-perception. When they're unskilled, they can't see their own faults. When they're exceptionally competent, they don't perceive how unusual their abilities are. So if the Dunning-Kruger effect is invisible to those experiencing it, what can you do to find out how good you actually are at various things? First, ask for feedback from other people and consider it, even if it's hard to hear. Second, and more important, keep learning. The more knowledgeable we become, the less likely we are to have invisible holes in our competence. Perhaps it all boils down to that old proverb. When arguing with a fool, first make sure the other person isn't doing the same thing.
This phenomenon isn't limited to just millennials. Mankind has suffered from it for millennium. You need to know your limits. You need to understand the reality of what's happening with you, the reality of your abilities. And sure, you should always stretch and try and reach another goal. If you can lift 200 pounds, you can try for 205, 210. So it's good to reach, but know what you can and can't do. The thing that I'm talking about here is personal initiative. What is that? That is behavior characterized by its self-starting nature, its proactive, not reactive approach, and by being persistent in overcoming difficulties that arise in pursuit of a goal. So what that means is that you'd get things done without people telling you to do them. It's like if you're at work, and this is the problem I've had with everyone that has worked for me in the past 35, 40 years. Let's say the floor in the shop is dirty. Well, my assistants will wait until I tell somebody to sweep it. And it's like I have to handhold people and tell them, you know what? The spindle on that machine is getting loose. I can hear it rattling. Why don't you tighten it? Well, nobody told me to. Well, the chickens need fresh water. Why don't you do that every day? Well, nobody told me to. There's lack of personal initiative. Napoleon Hill, many years ago, wrote a book. And in it, he tried to teach people how to gain control of their life. And here's a little clip that is about personal initiative.
Personal initiative is a dynamo which starts the faculty of imagination into action. In the process of translating one's definite major purpose into its physical or financial equivalent. If you aim for success above mediocrity, you will need to learn to act on your own personal initiative, because your success is something which you must achieve for yourself without someone telling you what to do or how to do it. The men who stand out in the minds of the public as the greatest successes from the days of George Washington on to the present are those who chose their own occupation, business, or profession and moved on their own personal initiative in achieving their purpose. And those who are getting ahead most rapidly today, no matter in what position they began, are those who promote themselves to a higher place in life by acting on their own personal initiative. The habit of personal initiative not only inspires one to move on his own responsibility, but it also influences him to carry through until he completes that which he undertakes. Because he knows that a winner never quits and a quitter never wins. I now wish to give you an outline of the more important attributes of the person who has sufficient personal initiative to give him leadership in his chosen occupation. First of all, the person who follows the habit of personal initiative has a definite major purpose in life and a plan for its attainment. He has the necessary persistence and the will to win to carry him along when the going is hard and he meets with obstacles. He makes decisions promptly when he has the necessary facts on which to base them and changes them slowly, if at all. He follows the habit of doing more than he is paid for, and he does so in a pleasing, positive mental attitude. He accepts full responsibility for everything he undertakes and never passes the buck when things go wrong. He can take friendly criticism without resentment because he has learned to profit by it. He has a well-developed sense of observation of small details and knows his job from the smallest detail to the greatest. He follows the habit of concentrating his full attention on one thing at a time. Last, but perhaps most important of all, He never puts off until tomorrow that which should have been done last week, because he knows that the habit of procrastination is near the top of the list of the causes of failure. When you come to examine yourself on the subject of personal initiative, just remember that your success or your failure depends very largely on the action you take in connection with your occupation. The decision must be your own, and you must follow through and carry out your decision on your own personal initiative. If you work for wages or a salary, you should decide to promote yourself through your own personal initiative to the top of the scale in your occupation. And remember that your promotion is entirely in your hands. There are two types of people who never amount to anything. Those who will not do what they are told, and those who will do nothing else.
So you get the idea of what he was talking about. Now, I'm going to tell you a story. I call it the story of Levi. I had a gun shop, corner of 8th and K Street in Modesto, California, for many years. In Modesto, half the year it's Mud-esto, and the other half it's Modesto. It was always dirty out front, and people would be tracking in dust and dirt all the time. One day, this black guy, kind of a weazened up old man, comes in, and he introduces himself because I like to talk to the owner, and I saw him, and he's about 5'8", probably weighed about 125 pounds. And I said, "What could I do for you?" He said, I'd like to make some money doing some work for you." And I said, "Well, I don't really need nobody to do anything." And he goes, "If you loan me a broom, I'll sweep the sidewalks in front and on the side of your building." I said, "Well, I could use that, yeah." So I gave him this broom. And he went out and he worked for 2 hours sweeping the dust up. He didn't just sweep it into the street. He came in and borrowed a dustpan and a garbage bag, and he swept it, all the dust that was out on these streets. Now, we're talking about 200 feet, 100 in the front and 100 in the side of sidewalk. He swept it all up, put it in a dustpan, put it in a bag, and he put the bag in the dumpster. And he comes in, and I said, "Well, what do I owe you for this? I'd rather not have pay. Can I have the broom and the dustpan?" And I was taken aback. I said, "Well, sure. You can have that broom and you can have the dustpan." Okay, then he went from my store next door to the farm and feed, and he said, "I'll sweep your sidewalk for a couple bucks." So they said, "Sure." So he went out and swept it up. And then he went down to the surplus store and he said the same thing. I thought that was kind of neat. This guy had self-initiative. So that he created his own work. He would come by every week. The next week he'd come by, he had a shopping cart. And it had that broom in it and dustpan and a roll of big black garbage bags and a big duster. And he said, "Okay, now what I can do, because I'm set up now, I've made enough money to where I bought a duster here, and I can dust off your metal bars out front." Every week, he would come by, he'd dust off all the metal bars and the front windows out there, and he'd sweep the sidewalk, and he never charged me, even though I tried to pay him. He refused it. He said, "You started my life over." I said, "All I do is give you a broom." He said, "Yeah, that's all I needed." So for at least 5 years, he would travel all around downtown Modesto. He was in charge of the sidewalks. He cleaned the sidewalks. He cleaned the windows. And then one day he had an apprentice with him. It was his nephew. And he was teaching him how to work. And he was teaching him. He said, "You don't ask what needs to be done. You know what needs to be done. You just need to do it." That is personal initiative. And that is what's lacking. Instead, what we have nowadays is people who say, "You know, I got an idea. I can work on the internet." Yeah, there's a lot of people who make money on the internet, and they dream up some idea of something. But you know what? They're not some guy that spends their whole teenage life living in a basement and playing video games. They actually went to school and they learned calculus. They learned how to write script and how to create computer languages. And then they took the knowledge that they had and they used that to do something. This is like what I did. In 1979, I was a computer quality control operator for Hewlett Packard. I helped build In fact, I was trained in the first dot matrix printer that came out. And I realized during that time that I was under the thumb of them because you weren't allowed to show any personal initiative with that company. I ended up quitting it. And from 1980 to now, I've never worked for another man or woman or semi-humanoid creature for that matter. So I've always worked for myself. That's called personal initiative. To me, it's not anything new. To many of you listening, in fact, most of you listening, you think that it's something, it's a superpower. You have a job, you work for the airlines, or you work for the train company, or you work for the city, or the county, or the state, or the federal government, and you're under the impression that's personal initiative. It could be, because personal initiative starts with the first concept that you have, that you want to do something, and you don't need somebody to tell you how to do it or when to do it, but you know that it has to be done. So you do it. These people who have personal initiative, that do work for other people, they will rise to the top of the heap, if you want to put it that way, because they're the kind of person that they can be let loose, and they don't have to have their boss standing over them, telling them what to do, when to do it, why to do it, and how to do it. Yeah, you got to learn a little bit first. It's just like flipping burgers. You got to learn when to flip them so they don't burn or they don't become undercooked. But most people, and I mean most people, they are like unprogrammed drones. They will learn the basics of their job, and that's all they do, and they do nothing other than that. I've watched people work on a lathe. A lathe is a metal spinning lathe where you're taking a bar of steel or aluminum and you're turning it and you're creating a pattern or pushing against the item with a sharp tool. I've watched people using a lathe drop a tool, and instead of bending over and picking it up, they'll grab another tool and keep on working, even though it's not the right tool. But they won't pick it up because it fell in amongst some shavings and stuff, and they don't want to bend over. I've watched people. I worked for American Can, and we did what's called palletizing. It's where we would take empty tin cans and sweep them onto a 4x4 pallet, and then put a piece of separator paper and put another layer on of these tin cans, and on and on and on and on. So sometimes that machine will get jammed up. A can will turn sideways or something in it. I have watched union members. These are good union members. The machine starts howling. It's got a jam. And they'll just turn it off and they'll go get their supervisor. Well, I'm not supposed to fix it. I don't know what I'm doing. I said, give me a second. So I walked over, reached in the machine, made sure it was off, pulled out the crushed can, and said, okay, now you're fine to go. I mean, what's the problem? I don't understand. Well, I didn't know how to fix it. They have something called an excuse. And this is the majority of humans nowadays on Earth, except for the ones that survive. The ones that survive, they don't have excuses. Why weren't you here at work on time? Well, traffic. And then the next day, why weren't you here on work on time? Well, there was a deer in the road. And you can go on and on and on and on and on. These are people who just have no personal initiative. They will never amount to anything other than being a drone, some position somewhere, some menial task, or working for the government. This is called Message to Garcia. This has been around for a long time. On the evening of February 22nd, 1899, the editor of the Philistine, Elbert Hubbard, he wrote a short inspirational essay that ran as a last-minute filler in the March 1899 issue of his magazine. He called it a literary trifle, and it was just took him an hour to do it. He had gotten in an argument with his son at dinner about who was the real hero of the Cuban War, the Spanish-American War, is what it was. His son said, "Oh, it's the hero of the whole war was a guy named Rowan." Now, Rowan was Andrew Summers Rowan, born 1857, died 1953. He was a lieutenant in the United States Army. And he was charged with the dangerous mission of delivering a message from President McKinley to a rebel commander in Cuba named Calixto Garcia. Rowan's mission was a success. He made contact with Garcia, who went on to play an important role during the war in support of U.S. troops. What Elbert Hubbard wrote, he titled A Message to Garcia. I'm going to read the whole thing to you. Starts off like this. Apologia. Horse sense. If you work for a man, in heaven's name, work for him. If he pays wages that supply you your bread and butter, you work for him. Speak well of him, think well of him, and stand by the institution he represents. I think if I worked for men, I would work for him. I would not work for him a part of the time, but all of the time. I would give an undivided service or none. If put to the pinch, an ounce of loyalty is worth a pound of cleverness. If you must vilify, condemn, and eternally disparage, why, resign your position, and when you are outside, damn to your heart's content. But I pray you, so long as you are a part of an institution, do not condemn it. Not that you'll injure the institution, no. But when you disparage the concern of which you are a part, you disparage yourself. This literary trifle, A Message to Garcia, was written one evening after supper in a single hour. It was on the 22nd of February, 1899, Washington's birthday, and we were just going to press with the March Philistine. This thing leapt hot from my heart when, after a trying day, when I had been endeavoring to train some rather delinquent villagers to abjure the comatose state and get radioactive. The immediate suggestion, though, came from a little argument over the teacups when my boy Bert suggested that Rowan was a real hero of the Cuban War. Rowan had gone alone and done the thing, carried the message to Garcia. It came to me like a flash. Yes, the boy is right. The hero is the man who does his work, who carries the message to Garcia. I got up from the table and wrote A Message to Garcia. I thought so little of it that we ran it in a magazine without a heading. The edition went out, and soon orders began to come for extra copies of the March Philistine. A dozen, 50, 100, and when the American News Company ordered 1,000, I asked one of my helpers which article it was that had stirred up the cosmic dust. It's that stuff about Garcia, he said. The next day, a telegram came from George Daniels of the New York Central Railroad. It read thus: Give price on 100,000 Rowan article in pamphlet form, Empire State Express advertisement on back. Also, how soon can ship? I replied, giving price, and stated we could supply the pamphlets in 2 years. Our facilities were small, and 100,000 booklets looked like an awful undertaking. The result was that I gave Mr. Daniels permission to reprint the article in his own way. He issued it in booklet form in editions of 500,000. 2 or 3 of these 500,000 lots were sent out by Mr. Daniels, and in addition, the article was reprinted in over 200 magazines and newspapers. It has been translated into all written languages. At the time Mr. Daniels was distributing the message to Garcia, Prince Hilikoff, director of Russian railways, was in the country. He was the guest of the New York Central and made a tour of the country under the personal direction of Mr. Daniels. The prince saw the little book and was interested in it, more because Mr. Daniels was putting it out in such big numbers, probably, than otherwise. In any event, when he got home, he had the matter translated into Russian, and a copy of the book had given to every railroad employee in Russia. Other countries then took it up, and from Russia it passed into Germany, France, Spain, Turkey, Hindustan, and China. During the war between Russia and Japan, every Russian soldier who went to the front was given a copy of the message to Garcia. The Japanese, finding the booklets in possession of the Russian prisoners, concluded that it must be a good thing and accordingly translated it into Japanese. And on an order of the Mikado, this is the godlike head of Japan, a copy was given to every man in the employ of the Japanese government, soldier or civilian. Over 40 million copies of A Message to Garcia have been printed. This is said to be a larger circulation than any other literary venture has ever attained during the lifetime of the author in all history, thanks to a series of lucky accidents. Now, the Apologia was written years afterwards. And then he continues on. Initiative. The world bestows its big prizes, both in money and in honors, for but one thing, and that is initiative. This actually is how my message to Garcia started. The word initiative. The world bestows its big prizes, both in money and in honors, for but one thing, and that is initiative. What is initiative? I'll tell you. It's doing the right thing without being told. But next to doing the thing without being told is to do it when you're told only once. That is to say, carry the message to Garcia. Those who can carry a message get high honors, but their pay is not always in proportion. Next, there are those who never do a thing until they were told twice. Such get no honors and small pay. Next, there are those who do the right thing only when necessity kicks them from behind, and these get indifference instead of honors and a pittance for pay. This kind spends most of his time polishing a bench with a hard luck story. Then still lower down in a scale than this, we have fellow who will not do the right thing even when someone goes along to show him how and stays to see that he does it. He's always out of a job and receives the contempt he deserves, unless he happens to have a rich pa, in which case destiny patiently awaits around a corner with a stuffed club. To which of these classes do you belong? And now it starts, A Message to Garcia by Elbert Hubbard. In all this Cuban business, there's one man stands out on the horizon of my memory like Mars at perihelion. When war broke out between Spain and the United States, it was very necessary to communicate quickly with the leader of the insurgents, Garcia. Garcia was somewhere in the mountain vastness of Cuba, and nobody knew where. No mail nor telegraph message could reach him. The president must secure his cooperation, and quickly. What to do? Someone said to the president, "There's this fellow by the name of Rowan. He'll find Garcia for you if anybody can." Rowan was sent for and given a letter to be delivered to Garcia. How the fellow named Rowan took the letter, sealed it up in an oilskin pouch, strapped it over his heart, in 4 days landed by night off the coast of Cuba from an open boat, disappeared into the jungle, and in 3 weeks came out on the other side of the island, having traversed a hostile country on foot and delivered his letter to Garcia, are things I have no special desire now to tell in detail. The point I wish to make is this. McKinley gave Rowan a letter to be delivered to Garcia. Rowan took the letter and did not ask, "Where is he?" By the eternal, there is a man whose form should be cast in deathless bronze and a statue placed in every college of this land. It's not book learning young men need, nor instruction about this and that, but a stiffening of the vertebrae, which will cause them to be loyal to a trust, to act promptly, concentrate their energies, do the thing, carry a message to Garcia. General Garcia is dead now. But there are other Garcias. No man who has endeavored to carry out an enterprise where many hands were needed, but has been well nigh appalled at times by the imbecility of the average man, the inability or unwillingness to concentrate on a thing and do it, slipshod assistance, foolish inattention, dowdy indifference, and half-hearted work seem the rule. And no man succeeds unless by hook or crook or threat. He forces or bribes other men to assist him, or mayhap God in his goodness performs a miracle and sends him an angel of light for an assistant. You, reader, put this matter to a test. You're sitting now in your office. 6 clerks are within call. Summon any one and make this request. Please look in the encyclopedia and make a brief memorandum for me concerning the life of Correggio. Will the clerk quietly say, "Yes, sir," and go do the task? On your life, he will not. He will look at you out of a fishy eye and ask one or more of the following questions. Who is he? Which encyclopedia? Where is the encyclopedia? Was I hired for that? Don't you mean Bismarck? What's the matter with Charlie doing it? Is he dead? Is there a hurry? Shan't I bring you the book and let you look it up yourself? What do you want to know for? And I'll lay you 10 to 1 that after you've answered the questions and explained how to find the information and why you want it, the clerk will go off and get one of the other clerks to help him try to find Garcia, and then come back and tell you there's no such man. Of course, I may lose my bet, but according to the law of average, I will not. Now, if you're wise, you'll not bother to explain to your assistant that Correggio is indexed under the C's, not in the K's, but you will smile sweetly and say, never mind, and go look it up yourself. And this incapacity for independent action, this moral stupidity, this infirmity of the will, this unwillingness to cheerfully catch hold and lift are the things that put pure socialism so far into the future. If men will not act for themselves, what will they do when the benefit of their effort is for all? A first mate with knotted club seems necessary, and the dread of getting the bounce Saturday night holds many a worker to his place. Advertise for a stenographer, and 9 out of 10 who apply can neither spell nor punctuate, and do not think it necessary to. Can such a one write a letter to Garcia? You see that bookkeeper, said the foreman to me in a large factory? Yes, what about him? Well, he's a fine accountant, but if I'd send him uptown on an errand, he might accomplish the errand all right. And on the other hand, he might stop at 4 saloons on the way, and when he got to Main Street, would forget what he had been sent for. Can such a man be entrusted to carry a message to Garcia? We've recently been hearing much maudlin sympathy expressed for the downtrodden denizen of the sweatshop and the homeless wanderer searching for honest employment, and with it all, often go many hard words for the men in power. Nothing is said about the employer who grows old before his time in a vain effort to get frowsy ne'er-do-wells to do intelligent work, and his long patient striving with help that does nothing but loaf when his back is turned. In every store and factory, there is a constant weeding-out process going on. The employer is constantly sending away help that have shown their incapacity to further the interests of the business, and others are being taken in. No matter how good times are, this sorting continues. Only if times are hard and work is scarce, the sorting is done finer. But out and forever out, the incompetent and unworthy go. It is the survival of the fittest. Self-interest prompts every employer to keep the best, those who can carry a message to Garcia. I know one man of really brilliant parts who's not the ability to manage a business of his own, and yet is absolutely worthless to anyone else because he carries with him constantly the insane suspicion that his employer is oppressing or intending to oppress him. He cannot give orders, and he will not receive them. Should a message be given to him to take to Garcia? His answer would probably be, take it yourself. Tonight, this man walks the streets looking for work. The wind whistling through his threadbare coat. No one who knows him dare employ him, for he is a regular firebrand of discontent. He is impervious to reason, and the only thing that can oppress him is the toe of a thick-soled size 9 boot. Of course, I know that one so morally deformed is no less to be pitied than a physical cripple. But in our pitying, let us drop a tear, too, for the men who are striving to carry on a great enterprise, whose working hours are not limited by the whistle, and whose hair is fast turning white through the struggle to hold in line dowdy indifference, slipshod imbecility, and a heartless ingratitude which, but for their enterprise, would be both hungry and homeless. Have I put matters too strongly? Possibly I have. But when all the world has gone a-slumming, I wish to speak a word of sympathy for the man who succeeds, the man who, against great odds, has directed the efforts of others, and having succeeded, finds there's nothing in it, nothing but bare board and clothes. I have carried a dinner pail and worked for day's wages, and I have also been an employer of labor, and I know there is something to be said on both sides. There is no excellence per se in poverty. Rags are no recommendation, and all employers are not rapacious and high-handed any more than all poor men are virtuous. My heart goes out to the man who does his work when the boss is away, as well as when he's at home, and the man who, when given a letter for Garcia, quietly takes the missive without asking any idiotic questions and with no lurking intention of chucking it in the nearest sewer or of doing aught else but deliver it, never gets laid off, nor has to go on strike for higher wages. Civilization is one long, anxious search for just such individuals. Anything such a man asks shall be granted. His kind is so rare that no employer can afford to let him go. He's wanted in every city, town, and village, in every office, shop, store, and factory. The world cries out for such. He is needed, and needed badly, the man who can carry a message to Garcia. the problem in the United States, again, I don't care about the rest of the world, they can handle their own problems or not, is that we allow the excuse to exist. The excuse. Why you can't do something. Why somebody wouldn't let you do something. Why you couldn't do something because somebody didn't do something before you. Why, excuse, but. Just this part that I talked about, personal initiative and the message to Garcia. Sometimes we need to just get up on our hind legs and howl at the moon. Sometimes we need to cowboy up and say that enough of this crap, let's make it work. And that is the measure of a being, is their ability to make something go right. It's what you can do that's right without an excuse. You know, it's kind of difficult for a lot of people because they were raised to have an excuse. They were raised to be able to apologize all the time because of their failures that were chronic. You know why? Why would somebody fail all the time at anything? Well, maybe they're not trained at it. Or maybe they want to fail that way on purpose because being a victim gives them standing in this society. I don't agree with the people that claim to be victims. I don't agree with the blacks that claim that whites are racist. I don't agree with the whites that claim that blacks are savages. I don't agree with the Democrats that say everybody is too stupid to have guns, kids, sharp knives, sharp sticks, cars, alcohol, what have you. I don't agree with any of that. What I agree with is that every man should be in charge of himself, but he should be worthy of being in charge of himself. And to do that, you have to make sure that you don't take the path of least resistance, like most people do. Morals are something that everyone needs to develop. And personal initiative is the basis of everything else out there. Well, anyway, this is the end of the show. So I appreciate you guys listening. I hope I didn't bore you too much. And if any of you are still awake, I hope you learned something. That's the whole intent here. The intent is to give you the data, give you power so that you can survive better. You know, I give information on firearms, on cars, on gardening, on cleaning, on repairs, on generators, on you name it, starting fires, putting fires out. That's only a little piece of it. And anybody can learn that, even a robot. But it's the human interaction that causes the problems. So that is the part where most survival incidents fail. It's where when the person gives up, when the person allows problems to stop him. You know, people come in the store and say, how you doing? How's life treating you? And I look at him and say, I'm the kind of guy that doesn't give a damn how life's treating me. You should be asking, how am I treating life? Anyway, you want to know what's happening with the Survival Enterprises, go to survivalenterprises.com, SE1.us. You can call us 7 days a week, 800-753-1981, 1-800-753-1981. And we'll be more than happy to talk to you, answer questions, yeah, what have you. And if we don't answer the phone, just leave a message. Our phone is on from 9 in the morning till 8 at night, 7 days a week. Unless I'm at the casino or something, you know. But just leave a message. And by the way, my son just informed me that he has all of my shows up to date on YouTube now. So I not only have all these other different places where you can go to listen to my show and download it, but YouTube also. You know, I've had a dozen people call me up in the past month and say, are you back on YouTube yet? I didn't think people listened on that. I thought it was just for looking at pretty kittens or how to disassemble an AK-47. Anyway,